Tom Woods Show, episode 1579.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, the Tom Woods Show.
Folks, as you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has been spreading some pretty terrible ideas, and she's wrong on just about everything. Well, I've put together the definitive smash of all of it. The Green New Deal, affordable housing so-called, free college, high tax rates. It's in another free ebook, yes, a free ebook, called AOC is Wrong, The Upside-Down World of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Grab your free copy at aociswrong.com. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. Very glad to welcome back to the show Mike Meharry, who is communications director for the 10th Amendment Center, which you can check out at 10thamendmentcenter.com. I support them very strongly. We're going to talk about Mike's new book, but before we do that, I'm always pleased to see the different knowledge bases that different Tom Woods Show listeners have and the diversity of interests people have and skills and all the things you guys are up to. So I'm very glad to note that one of my listeners, Maureen Boswell, has just started a website called The Diet Oracle. So you can find it at thedietoracle.com. And the idea is it's a nutrition blog that will maybe help you lose weight. So it's weight loss tips and tactics, cooking techniques, recipes, grocery shopping and meal planning tips, in-depth discussions of popular diets, how to get the best results, and so on. Maureen is a registered dietitian, nutritionist, and exercise physiologist, brings 15 years of experience to the table, so very much worth checking out at thedietoracle.com. And she got her hosting, of course, through my link, so I give her a little publicity like this, and I very much support what she's doing. And she gets other nice bonuses too, like membership in my Mutual Help Bloggers group. So if this appeals to you, then before you get your hosting, check out the details of all my goodies at tomwoods.com/publicity. I'll link to her website on today's show notes page, tomwoods.com/1579. Now, the book we're talking about today, you know, I'm going to ask Mike about this because I know some of you will say, oh, I don't care about the Constitution. I just care about libertarianism. I totally understand that. I totally do. But on the other hand, I'm a historian and the Constitution is an old thing. So naturally, I have a kinship with it, right? It's an old thing. I'm interested in it. I like old things. But his book is called Constitution Owner's Manual, The Real Constitution the Politicians Don't Want You to Know About. Mike, welcome back.
Thank you, Tom. It's always an honor and a privilege to be on the Tom Woods Show.
Thank you very much. Well, you have this brand new book I just told the folks about, Constitution Owner's Manual. You know, people may be jaded. There are a lot of books on the Constitution. There are a lot of people saying, oh, if only we could get back to the Constitution. Why this book? What makes it different? What are you setting out to do?
I'll be honest with you. I'm pretty jaded about it myself. And, you know, this is kind of a culmination of almost a decade of studying and writing about the Constitution. And this is a good lesson for folks who might want to write a book. You know, if you write a lot of articles and posts, you can start cobbling them together and eventually you have a book. But I think it is important right now because at some level, most Americans still believe in at least the idea of the Constitution. You know, there's some respect for that document. And I think it's important, given that people have some basic understanding of what it actually means, because 99% of people don't have any clue what the Constitution says or mean, even in the most basic forms. But, you know, the fact that it is still important, I realized this the other day, or it was reaffirmed the other day. I was accidentally watching the opening statements of this ridiculous kabuki theater that is this impeachment hearing, and Adam Schiff happened to be on. I was at the gym on the elliptical, so I wasn't watching this on purpose. You know, I have to preserve my reputation here. But anyway, this guy was up here talking about the Constitution and even referenced the Philadelphia Convention, and he was talking about, you know, the original meaning of the Constitution as it relates to impeachment. And I thought, you know, this guy doesn't care anything at all about the Constitution. He's the chair of the Intelligence Committee, for goodness sake. He's the one authorizing the NSA to spy on everybody in the world. So, you know, he doesn't care about the Constitution, but he recognizes at some level that the Constitution is important. And I think given that Americans still hold this document up to be important in the basis of government, it's important that they understand what it means and that they understand that the government that we have today has traveled 100 million miles away from what was originally intended. So I think that's why it's important. I think what I bring to the table is the fact that I'm a journalist and, you know, I write for kind of the common person. So it's not, you know, it's not an intellectual or an academic type of treatment of the topic. It's more of a popular treatment, and I think people will enjoy kind of the analogies that I use and whatnot. So it's kind of, I don't want to say it's simplified, because it's not simplified in any way, shape, or form, but it is targeted at a general audience.
Yeah, but I'm going to say I think it's maybe the best quick resource somebody can read on this subject, because you're so consistently right on every doggone thing.
Because I've been reading you.
Well, you know, that is one of the side effects of reading Woods. But honestly, everything that I'd want to say, you're saying. And you're saying it really briefly, but with the citations and with reference to, you know, valuable and important sources. This is the quick version. Now, you could read volume after volume after volume to glean what you've got here, but you've already done that. You've done the gleaning. So I really would steer people to this particular book. Now, obviously, if I go into a typical classroom, I'm going to hear crazy nonsense about the Constitution.
Right.
Probably taught by somebody on the left. But on the other hand, if I go to some traditional, or I don't even want to say traditional, let's say some outlets of Conservatism, Inc.
Yes.
I'm also going to get things about the Constitution that aren't right.
Right. So especially war powers.
War powers, but also a lot of them will be unsound on the compact theory, the one American people. So you're setting absolutely everybody straight. And so before you get into the particular parts of the Constitution that you're going to go through, you start with these big questions.
Yeah, I really tried to do that because I wanted to establish that first, that the United States is not one nation, because that's the biggest fallacy that I run into out there. And that skews everybody's thinking. And we have this mentality that the president is basically the king and Congress is there to pass some laws to give the president power to do king stuff. And the judges are there to rubber stamp whatever Congress and the president want to do. I mean, that's basically the structure. And I wanted to really, going all the way back to the colonial era and the conception of a constitution that the English had, and show how that was different, how that changed, how the idea of governance evolved in the American mind, and then build on that to the Constitution, and then, you know, go through these various provisions and principles and show what they said during the ratification debates that these things were supposed to mean.
Why does it matter, and here I'm referencing your chapter three, whether we're dealing with sovereign states or, you know, as you know, the super precise version would be the sovereignty of the peoples of the states or one American people in the aggregate. What practical difference does that seemingly theoretical question make?
Well, it all comes down to, you know, who is ultimately in charge. And if it's the one nation concept that we've all been taught, then it's ultimately true in practice that Washington, D.C. can dictate things like how much water is in our toilet and what kind of light bulbs we can screw into our light fixtures. That flows out of this one nation idea. The compact theory, the idea that states are sovereign, mean that most of governance is supposed to be done at the state level. That means it's a decentralized system. And if you ask me, what is the biggest threat to liberty? My answer is always going to be a big centralized state. I think centralization is the biggest threat to liberty. So the Constitution certainly isn't perfect. States are not good in any sense of the word, but it's better to have 50 relatively independent entities doing things as opposed to having everything dictated for 320 million people out of Washington, D.C. And I use this analogy a lot when I'm speaking. You know, everybody intuitively understands we don't want a monopoly in groceries. You know, if I was the king of the world and I said, Walmart is going to supply everybody's groceries in the entire United States, most people would go, oh no, that's a horrible idea. You know, you'll get bad service, you'll get high prices, all of these things. But that's effectively what this one nation idea of governance is. It's a monopoly government and it's dangerous to liberty. So if people can understand that the states have some sovereignty, then that gives us some political tools, which is what we do at the 10th Amendment Center, to push back against this federal overreach and reassert some state and local control, which I think is a better shot at having something akin to liberty than what we have now with the DC monopoly version of government.
Now, I'm just going to go in order. Obviously, I'm not going to cover every one of these, but I want to try to follow the conceptual framework that you've observed here, because I'd like to, you could have an episode on each one of these topics. And I have done episodes on war powers and on the Electoral College and on the natural born citizen stuff and nullification and I've done general welfare clause, necessary and proper commerce. I've done all this at length. But what you've done here is take it and just, you've got, in sometimes these chapters are 5, 6, 7, 8 pages, 10 pages. Mm-hmm. You've got like the most devastating passages and quotations that just blow every other perspective on this out of the water. Now, having said that, you will get pushback from some people, particularly some libertarians, who will say the Constitution was never, you've heard this, was never meant to limit government. It gave us a stronger government, and people like you try to pretend that it was supposed to give us a limited government, but it wasn't supposed to. It was supposed to give us kind of like, if not what we have now, then certainly, at the very least, it was not intended to limit government. How do you answer that?
Well, I guess, you know, it's all relative, right? I mean, certainly the constitutional framework is more limited than what we have today. And, you know, I'm a big believer in principles. I mean, I love to read people like Spooner. And, you know, I can make the argument that the Constitution, just from a philosophical, ethical standpoint, isn't legitimate. But we live in a real world with a real government that purports to be based on this document. That's why I think it's important to understand what it is. And it's certainly more limited than what we have today. You know, when you look at things like general welfare today means whatever the federal government wants to do to make life better for us. That was not the understanding of general welfare at the ratification. So it's much more limited then than it is now. So if we can do things in the, if we're going to be engaged in the political process, then we have to work within the framework that we're given. The Constitution does give us some ways that we can push back and try to roll back things to where it is more limited. And I would certainly agree with people that, you know, it's the Constitution was more, gave the centralized government more power than the Articles of Confederation, but we don't have the Articles of Confederation, so we can't really go back there. But we can try to push back towards the intended meanings of some of these clauses and utilize nullification. This is really, to me, understanding the Constitution is really a framework for nullification, using state and local power to push back against federal overreach and create some decentralized processes within the body politic of today.
Now, as I said, I've covered sort of the three big ones, general welfare, necessary and proper, and commerce clause before, and you and I off the top of our heads know why those clauses don't mean what the third grade textbook says they mean. We have all the passages in the world that you could ask for from Madison and others making that perfectly clear. However, you have in here a short little section, but nevertheless, a section on the preamble. You could very easily have skipped the preamble because, as you say, it's merely declaratory. It's not legally binding in any way. But is there something that we can derive from the preamble?
Yeah, absolutely. The preamble, you know, understanding what the preamble is extremely important. And this is where I get a lot of people from the right going off the tracks immediately when they start talking about the Constitution, because they start referring to the preamble like the preamble authorizes the government to do all of these broad sweeping things. The preamble was simply a statement of intent. You know, we would like to do these things. And then it gave us the enumerated powers that the federal government can use toward those ends. The preamble without the enumerated powers is effectively an unlimited government. So understanding that kind of legal structure is really important. And a lot of people go off the rails by citing the preamble as some type of grant of power. So, you know, that's why I thought it was important to include that. And it's interesting, you can go back all the way back to the Alien and Sedition Acts, and there were some actors that were in favor of those acts that actually referred to the preamble. So, you know, this isn't anything new. This was going on really almost since the time that the ink was dry on the Constitution.
Let's see. As I say, there are such big issues here that I don't want to force you to get into. What I love is that you have all these sections in the book that you would expect in a book on the Constitution, and then suddenly, chapter 17 hits you like a thunderbolt. Federal highway funding is unconstitutional. Right. So I have no, I just feel like I have no choice but to ask you to say something about that.
Yeah, I threw that in there because it kind of builds on, it kind of summarizes the previous chapters, and it's really just kind of a practical application. And I love the fact, basically what this chapter covers very quickly is Madison's veto of a bill that effectively It was kind of a roads bill. It was an infrastructure bill. And I love the fact that Madison was for the federal government doing these things, but he vetoed this bill because of the constitutional issues. And, you know, a rare moment of a politician having some principle. So that's really why I included it. If you actually just read that very short veto message, it's a lesson in constitutional law right there that I wish any lawyer would actually read at some point, because he just lays out the point and he goes through each of these things. You know, it's not under the general welfare. It's not necessary and proper. We have an amendment process. If you want to do these things, I'm for it. Let's amend the Constitution. So, yeah, I had to throw that in there just because it gives you a practical sense of what – how limited the Constitution was. Because when you say that today, you know, the highway funding is unconstitutional, people will just look at you like you're from Mars or someplace. I like the way you put it. It is kind of a thunderbolt, and it was intended to be that way and to kind of throw people off a little bit and, you know, make people want to read that chapter. At least,
oh,
right?
Yeah, because it stands out so much, because the other ones are called, you know, privileges and immunities, right. Full faith and credit, the Bill of Rights, the First Amendment, federal highway funding. I just love it. And plus, of course, there's also the subtext
the
of
roads?
Who will build the roads. Yeah, right. So
yes.
it works so well. I'm going to skip ahead here to the Bill of Rights. That's maybe the longest chapter, actually. And then you spend some time going into four specific amendments from the Bill of Rights.
Right.
But let's start with the Bill of Rights. In fact, I'm going to go back and double check that I'm right about that. It's at the very least, it's tied as the longest chapter. Why is that?
Well, because I got into the whole incorporation issue. And for a lot of people, this is going to be the most controversial chapter in the book, because virtually everybody believes that the Bill of Rights applies to federal government in the states. And to me, it's absolutely undeniable that the Bill of Rights, as originally written, were never intended to apply to the states. And I think the idea that the 14th Amendment somehow incorporated the Bill of Rights onto the states is dubious at best. So I actually dig into that. I reference Raoul Berger quite a bit. I think he's the best 14th Amendment scholar out there. And I just thought it was important to lay that out. And again, it's going to upset a lot of people, particularly libertarians who kind of want the federal government to be a liberty enforcement squad and make the states follow the Bill of Rights. I understand the impetus to do this. I think it's dangerous because it gets us back to this whole monopolization of government, plus the fact that the federal courts are awful when it comes to actually, you know, defining what those rights are supposed to be. So usually they're incorporating garbage on the states to begin with. But I thought it was really important to get into that and lay that out and make it very clear that the Bill of Rights is a limit on the federal government and it wasn't ever intended to apply to the states.
Now, as I say, you picked out the first, the second, the fourth, and the ninth amendments. Now, obviously, there are 10 amendments in the Bill of Rights, so you
right.
must have felt like you had something to say about these four that either hasn't been said or people just don't understand. So I'd like to go, let's skip ahead. Let's go all the way ahead to the ninth amendment. I'm pretty sure I once read, I liked Robert Bork. I actually thought he was a good guy. I didn't agree with him on everything, but I thought he was
right.
very smart, and I liked his book. But I seem to recall him saying something along the lines of, and I'm probably being unfair to him, nobody knows what the Ninth Amendment means. He said something like that. Does Mike Meharry know what the Ninth Amendment means?
I do know what the Ninth Amendment means. And, you know, it's interesting because the Ninth Amendment was really a product of adding a Bill of Rights to the Constitution. There were a lot of people that were afraid, you know, if you start enumerating these rights, if you start saying the federal government can't infringe on the right to keep and bear arms or freedom of speech or these specific things, then people are going to interpret that to mean that rights that aren't listed, the federal government can get involved in those things. And of course, that's absurd from the enumerated structure of the Constitution itself, but that's what people were afraid of. So the Ninth Amendment was actually added to ensure that nobody interpreted the Bill of Rights that way, that it was saying that just because we're listing these certain rights, that doesn't mean that the federal government can infringe on certain rights that are not listed. So it really works together with the 10th Amendment. You could almost put the 9th and the 10th together because they're effectively saying the same thing from a different direction, and that is that the federal government can only do those things that it's enumerated and empowered to do, and it can't do anything else. The 9th and 10th Amendment are effectively rules of construction that tell us to read the Constitution that way.
Right. So what you could say is that even if the Second Amendment were to be read the way some people want us to read it, where it just means that the National Guard can be armed.
Right.
You know, which is, Yeah, like, are they really thinking that our proposal is the National Guard not be armed? I mean, right. That's not related to the, that can't be what that means. But even if it were what that meant, you'd still have the right to bear arms protected under the Ninth Amendment as an unenumerated right.
Absolutely.
And there it is, you know?
I've even made the argument that if you didn't have the Second Amendment at all, the federal government would have very little power to regulate our individual right to keep and bear arms. There's no enumerated power to do that.
That's right.
So,
yeah.
Yeah.
And by the way, that's what you see in the ratifying conventions, because before there even was a Bill of Rights, when they were discussing the Constitution as submitted to them, they couldn't appeal to any Ninth or Tenth Amendment or Second Amendment because they didn't exist.
Right.
But what the assurances were that you got, and this is what Kevin Gutzman is fond of pointing out, you got these assurances not from this wasn't arguments made by the anti-federalists. These were the arguments made by the Federalist supporters of the Constitution in Richmond, saying the federal government is going to have only those powers expressly delegated to it. The words expressly delegated were in there. Well, there's no power to interfere with firearms ownership. So therefore, that's not expressly delegated. It doesn't have that power. There it is. You don't need a Second Amendment, a Ninth Amendment, a Tenth Amendment. You just need the original Constitution. Now, it's true there are some people who are going to want to interfere with them anyway, you know, but that's going to be true no matter how many amendments you put in there.
Exactly.
That was the original understanding, so to speak. All right. So what do you have to say, though, about the Fourth Amendment that might be of relevance to us today, especially in this, you know, techno information age? What needs to be said about the Fourth Amendment?
Well, I think the principle underlying the Fourth Amendment is important. You know, it's interesting because you'll get people who will want to try to limit the amendments in the Bill of Rights to the time. So, you know, these are the people that say, well, they never could have imagined an assault rifle, which, I don't know, they were pretty smart people. I think they probably recognized that there would be more powerful weapons that would be developed. You know, it's just me. But I think the important thing to understand was the principle behind the Fourth Amendment, why the Fourth Amendment was included, the history that led to that, which were, you know, the British using these writs of assistance, which were essentially open-ended warrants that authorized government agencies to search wherever they want, whenever they want. They were transferable. It was important to the founding generation that that never happened again, that if the government was going to be able to search things, that they would have to specify what they were searching for, where they were going to search for it, and you know, have probable cause to do this. So that applies whether you're talking about a piece of paper or a bit of information on the computer. And so that chapter primarily focuses on that history that led up to the Fourth Amendment and emphasizes the importance of privacy as a right. I actually quote Glenn Greenwald a little bit. He did a really good TED Talk about why privacy is important and why these people who run around and say, well, you know, if you don't have anything to hide, you have nothing to fear, why they're full of you know what. So I just think it's important to lay that out in this day and age when, you know, to me, surveillance is one of the most grievous overreaches of government that we see today. And it's getting worse and worse, and technology is enabling this. So, and it's a big focus of our work at the 10th Amendment Center, trying to rein in all of the surveillance technology.
Let's go back now, and I make no apologies for jumping around. This is a topic where I just feel like jumping around. There are so many different things to say and so many things occurring to me at different moments. I do want to say something about your chapter 12, or I'd like you to say something about it. Who decides constitutionality? Yeah, that's the question, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because you have a document and it's impossible for an inanimate object to enforce itself. So
right.
Somebody has to decide if it's being violated. And the question is who? Here's another area where the official conservative movement gets it wrong. Of course, you know, the progressive left is going to get this wrong too. They decide constitutionality, or really, I almost say that nothing's unconstitutional except, you know, their three pet issues. But other than that,
right.
It's whatever the federal government wants to do.
Right.
How do you think we should be looking at that?
Well, I like to approach it just from the absurdity of the idea that these five judges effectively get to determine the powers of the federal government. And this chapter builds on the chapters that precede it. So I kind of work up to, you know, this idea of that it's state sovereignty and how the Constitution was developed and how the Americans began to think of government. And so this is kind of the culmination of that. Okay, we have this Constitution. It's clear that it was supposed to limit government. Who decides? And if you understand those principles, if you understand that this document only enumerated specific powers, then it's absolutely absurd on its face to say that a federal court gets to decide federal power. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. So I use a couple of kind of amusing anecdotes to illustrate the absurdity of that, mainly the idea of a referee. You know, if you have a referee, the referee has the power to make decisions within his scope, which is the football game or the hockey game or whatever type of game it is. A hockey referee doesn't have the authority to make a ruling on the football field, and he certainly doesn't have the power to pull you over and write you a ticket. So this idea of sovereignty, this idea of being within your bounds, I think is important for people to understand. And ultimately, the idea that the Supreme Court is the final say of all things constitutional is absurd because, again, it makes the federal government effectively unlimited. And Thomas Jefferson lays this out perfectly in the Kentucky Resolutions of 1798. And I actually quote from that in there. I really tried to use a lot of quotes from the ratifying era and in the years after to emphasize these points and let them kind of carry the argument. So it's not Mike Meharry's opinion, but you know, this is what these guys said. And if you have a problem with it, then argue with them.
I love the fact that as appendices, more or less, you have not just the Constitution itself, but also the Virginia and Kentucky Resolutions of 1798. I believe it was Campaign for Liberty, Ron Paul's organization that he started after his 2008 campaign, that when it put out its pocket Constitution, it had those resolutions in it, which is, I think, a deeply subversive thing to do. And yeah. I like subversion, so I was all in favor of that. And so I'm glad that you're putting that in there, because really that the Kentucky Resolutions of 1798 really are probably the classic description of the compact theory of the Union. It's a compact expression of the compact theory of the Union, right? It's as brief as it can be, but it's just bulletproof and excellent. Yeah. So excellent. I'm so glad that's in there.
And I'll tell you exactly why I did that. I will never forget this. This is one of those kind of formulative moment things. You know, I started working with the 10th Amendment Center. It's been 10 years ago. And when Bolton took me on, I didn't know very much. I really kind of look back and wonder, why did he put me in this position? I don't know. But he gave me some stuff to read. And the first things on the list were the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions. And I will never forget, I was sitting on my couch and I had these things pulled up on my iPad. And I was like, how have I not read these? You know, I'm an educated person. I took college level history courses. I had no idea that these documents existed. So I think any time that we can put these documents in front of people's eyes is extremely important, because it radically changed the way that I looked at the Constitution and at government. And, you know, that was kind of the beginning of a long path for me that led to crazy anarchist writing Constitution book, you know. But they were just extremely important in my development. And I couldn't believe that nobody had ever told me about these before.
Yeah, they make for tremendous reading. So look, I'd love to keep on talking, but I really want people to check this thing out, because as I say, it's got all the kinds of arguments I would want people to be aware of. It's, you know, all the sorts of things that really it's like only people in our circles are even aware of. And you've got all of them relentlessly and in brief. So, the book, of course, is Constitution Owner's Manual, The Real Constitution the Politicians Don't Want You to Know About, by our guest, Michael Meharry, linked today on our show notes page, tomwoods.com/1579. You can also get it directly over at constitutionownersmanual.com. We'll take you right to the various outlets that carry it. So, constitutionownersmanual.com, which is the name of the book, is also a way for you to pick up a copy. Well, Mike, thank you as always for your labors, and a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you, Tom, for having me on. I really appreciate it. And I appreciate all of the work that you've done on this. I, you know, like I said, I pulled from folks like you and Kevin Gutzman, who people have heard on the show before, and Brian McClanahan, who was kind enough to write the foreword. Without you guys mentoring me and teaching me, this book wouldn't exist. So thank you.
Good man, Mike. I appreciate that. Thanks a lot. Okay, folks, that's going to do it. Mike mentioned Kevin Gutzman and Brian McClanahan. Well, they teach U.S. history along with me at libertyclassroom.com. So if you really want to learn the real, real, real history, that's where you're going to go, libertyclassroom.com. And you can get a coupon. And yes, I am pronouncing it correctly. I am not going to pronounce it the old lady way of coupon. Stop that. The correct pronunciation is coupon, and I will hear no dissent on this. And by the way, not there's anything wrong with being an old lady. You know, they're some of the best people in the world. But anyway, you can get yourself coupon codes for Liberty Classroom over at libertyclassroom.com/coupons. I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.